Welcome to another edition of the TDN Writers Room, brought to you by Keeneland. I'm Zoe Campbell with First Racing and XBTV, and I am not the one and only Bill Finley. Apparently, Bill might have bit into a Christmas pudding a little bit too early, Randy. Do you do this in America with Christmas puddings, where people put money, like coins, into the pudding?
I've never heard of that. But then you asked me if I was going to wear a jumper on the Christmas telecast, and I didn't know what that was either.
Well, it's a Christmas tradition. You put money in the Christmas pudding. So usually every Christmas, many years ago, there'd be some grandma or a granny or auntie missing a front tooth because they bit into the penny or the pound coin in the Christmas pudding. And I have a feeling that's what's happened to our one and only Bill Finley.
Well, I do know what bangers and mash and fish and chips are, and I like them both. So, but I've never eaten pudding with money in it. It's something really? I'll have to try.
No. I'll have to send you a Christmas pudding. All right. So we mentioned last week and the week before about what is going on at Woodbine. Well, it appears that nothing has been fixed and it's still going on. And I feel for the people at Woodbine. Six fatalities since the November the 9th card. Bill Ford said they are simply monitoring closely situations. Now, last Thursday, Spike Races fell and suffered a catastrophic injury. Less than 24 hours later, Mad Chairman also broke down in Friday's first race. They've introduced new rules and protocols, basically in line with what we have going on here at Santa Anita, and these were brought in place by the Alcohol and Gaming Commission, AGCO. Horses cannot run back within 14 days. We're going to have pre-race inspections and a pre-veterinary workout inspections 48 hours out, which is exactly what has been put in place by the Stronach group here at Santa Anita, and it's been working. So a lot of protocols going on. What are your thoughts moving forward, Randy?
Well, you know, we know from the data, and I think the data is very important, that the Tapeta racing surface is generally safer than a dirt racing surface. I mean, there have been reams of data at various different racetracks, including Woodbine, that have pretty much proven that. So it's after the initial wave of breakdowns, they went back and reexamined everything that they were doing with Tapeta, from the content of the surface to the way it was maintained. So it's really hard to point the finger at the racing surface. So then you have the same sorts of situations that you had at Santa Anita. And even in New York about 15 years ago, when they had a spate of breakdowns and they formed a commission to try to investigate those breakdowns. And they turn over every rock and they try to look at the way horses are being trained, the way they're being entered. I know at Santa Anita, they looked at the fact that you had a very rainy winter that year and the racing surface was packed down a lot to try to drain the rainfall that might have contributed to it. But look, I mean, the data also shows that horses that race within 2 weeks in particular, even 30 days, are more prone to catastrophic injury than those horses that have had more recuperating time since their most recent start. And I don't think 14 days is particularly draconian. I mean, very few horsemen nowadays are really willing to run horses back, certainly not on a regular basis, in 14 days. I know there were some scratches at Woodbine as a result of this. But I think a lot of that has to do, Zoe, with the fact that the Woodbine meeting is coming to a close. And there's obviously a lot of money there. And guys want to get as many races as they can before their horses take the winter off, like a lot of those horses do up in Canada. So I don't know if there's any hard and fast answer to this. I mean, we're not privy to exactly what's being, you know, discovered behind the scenes. But I've got no problem with the 14-day mandate. Any horses that have raced within 14 calendar days shall be deemed ineligible and shall be scratched by the stewards, as well as some of the other protocols they've come up with.
Moving forward into Sunday's card, I believe when I checked, there were 7 pending scratches due to this new protocol. In its ruling, the AGCO cited that there were 15 musculoskeletal injuries, 9 of those resulting to euthanasia. Now, it's hard to blame the track. It's hard to blame the people. Things come in numbers once something happens. We've been through it. I went through it at Arlington. We went through it at Santa Anita. New York has gone through it. It's a horrible thing, but it seems to me that they're doing everything they can in their power to try and remedy the situation.
Yeah. And we know as a whole, nationally, the rate of catastrophic breakdowns is lower now in the past year, year and a half than it's been in a long, long time since those statistics were first being kept. But as we all know, and as we say pretty often, there's no way to completely eliminate catastrophic breakdowns. Horses break down, they suffer injuries in the wild when they're running in the paddock. I mean, certainly when they're in the heat of competition during a race, there's no way to completely avoid any types of injuries. And statistically, some are going to occur bunched together more often than others. It's not going to be a real neat spacing of injuries. Hopefully that's what we're looking at here at Woodbine. And I guess the proof will just be going forward, what the situation is there with these new protocols.
All right, let's move on to a happier note. And Bill will be sad he missed this one. Rated by Merit, won again. 4 for 4, the 11th horse to sweep the Florida Stakes Sire Series since 1982. Rated by Merit. How good is he? What number did he get?
I think he got a 93 buyer speed figure for this win, as opposed to the 99 that he had in the most recent stakes race in the series. Look, I mean, in many cases, horses that win these Stallion Series races in Florida at Gulfstream, some of those ones that have swept in the past, were kind of lightly regarded because obviously the restricted nature of those races doesn't lend itself to competing against the toughest rivals, right? In this case, though, I think Rated by Merit is getting more attention maybe than a lot of the other horses that came before him, just because of how fast he's been running. I mean, he has been, running sensationally fast times for 2-year-olds. Now, the only question, I suppose, going forward, Zoe, is Rated by Merit a horse that's going to now take the next step forward when he continues to run around 2 turns against the better 3-year-olds that are going to be coming down from New York and coming over from Kentucky? Or is he just one of these super precocious type horses that is going to plateau early in his career and is going to kind of keep this same level all the way through and might be caught and passed by some of the 2-year-olds that'll be improving next year? It's an interesting question, but boy, is he fast.
Yeah, and that was his first start around 2 turns. He's not that pretty to watch in the final 16th because he got to kind of wobbling around a little bit and looked like he got a little bit tired, but he's quick early, and it'll be really interesting to see how he matches up when he jumps out of State Bred Company.
He's one of these horses that when you watch run, you say, okay, he's a good horse. He won by 8, but he didn't blow me away. He won by 6, but he looked good. And then you see how fast he ran. You're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Wait a second, and the track wasn't particularly fast at Gulfstream Park on Saturday. So that makes his final time look even better.
Okay, let's move on and talk about the Brad Cox segment of this podcast right now, as he had one, but 2 rising stars at Churchill. We'll start with the 46th rising star for that Super Stud Stallion Into Mischief. And that was a Chaston by Into Mischief out of lockdown, makes this one a half sister to that wonderful, wonderful, massive mare, Idiomatic. Was that what you were expecting from her? She's almost as big as her sister.
She wasn't the betting favorite.
No, 3-1.
Which, given her pedigree, would sort of, and given the fact that it's Brad Cox as the trainer, who's great with first-time starters in Kentucky, would sort of, I think, be an indication that maybe she wasn't blowing some of the horsemen away by her works. And the fact that she was in blinkers first time out and she didn't have trouble at the start, really. I mean, she might have got herself pinched back a little bit because she didn't jump very quickly, which happens a lot with horses. But, I mean, she was last. She was last a few strides out of the gate, probably six or seven lengths back. When you say rising star, TD and rising star, I think the emphasis here should be on rising, because the buyer figure for this particular race, I think, comes back a 68 or a 69. If this was a horse with a different pedigree and a different trainer, nobody would even be giving this horse any consideration whatsoever. But the fact that she's big, like Idiomatic was, and the fact that she's her half-sister, Idiomatic was by Curlin, Chastin's by Into Mischief, would obviously put her more in the spotlight than I think this particular performance itself might deserve. Now, can she, continue to improve like Idiomatic did? It's entirely possible, but I think maybe at this point in her career, she may be slightly overrated, but we'll see.
And just to let everybody know, we do not do the rising stars here. Myself, Randy, nor Bill do the rising stars in here. So don't be writing in saying she was a rising star. Anyway, she was a rising star. That's Chastin. One race later or two race later is the 47th rising star. And this was good. This was absolutely eye-catching. Patch Adams went his final 3/8 in 35.06, I think. He was 0.33 off of Groupie Doll's track record, running 7 furlongs in 120.77, winning by 10.5 lengths. How good is Patch Adams?
Oh, he sure looked awfully good in this particular spot. A 98 buyer speed figure that maybe could have even been a little bit higher. Second lifetime start, came out of a fast maiden race at Keeneland, but he took his game to the next level. He didn't benefit from a clear early lead. He was right with he was on the pace, but, he was outside, rated nicely. Separated with another horse. Zat's the one, the horse that was part of the pace. And they came to the head of the stretch, right together, really. And then Patch Adams just left them all behind. Very impressive performance. We'll see about the two turns thing, because that's probably, where Patch Adams will be going next. Brad Cox's horses will be based primarily at the fairgrounds. He'll have the fairgrounds and Oaklawn Park as options. But this is a horse that really, really deserves a lot of attention going forward. And by the way, just in case you're wondering, Patch Adams is a real life doctor based in Washington, D.C., who is known for using humor as part of his medical and social activism. And he was his life story was told on screen in a movie of the same name, Patch Adams, starring Robin Williams. So if Patch Adams continues to go down the road as a top 3-year-old, we may be seeing and hearing from the real life Patch Adams at some point along the way.
No question. I thought you were actually going to go down the rabbit hole and talk about his pedigree, because look what I have right here, Randy. Do you see what I'm holding?
Yes.
You have that too? Look at us. We are both holding Jay Hovde's book on Well Armed, A Thoroughbred of Destiny. Have you read it yet?
I have not read it yet. I've just kind of leafed through it a little bit. It's Bill Kasner's basically, life story, and the horse's life story as well, which is a remarkable story.
And the coincidences in this are absolutely mind-boggling. Once you read it, you'll get chills. You'll be like, bloody hell. Really? Written by Jay Hovde. And the reason we're talking about this is because Patch Adams is out of Well Humored, who's out of a life well lived, who is a full sister to Well Armed. And it is a must read.
Bred and co-owned by Windstar Farm, who obviously had Well Armed, along with Sienna Farm and the China Horse Club. So some powerful ownership.
Very
as well.
Powerful indeed. So Cox, Patch Adams, he's probably going to be on a lot of people's radars moving forward. All right, I did mention that the TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Make plans to attend the 3-day January sale, which will be held from January the 13th to the 15th. Keeneland's January sale, horses of all ages, is noted for high-quality broodmare prospects and short yearlings, and for being among the final opportunities for breeders to obtain stock as the breeding season nears. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
Keeneland, a horse will always be measured in hands. Hands that see, that sense, that speak. Hands that hold our sport to a higher standard. Not for our sake, but for theirs. For the love of the horse, for generations to come.
Time now for the TDN's Fastest Horse of the Week, brought to you this week by Two Fills, one of my many, many favorite horses. Two Fills, one of the fast sires at Windstar Farm. They like to say that he's too fast. Two Fills has got a lot of evidence to show exactly how fast he was. First of all, when he was second in the Kentucky Derby, he earned a lofty buyer speed figure of 105, but there's a lot more than just that. He won the Ohio Derby in the fastest time since that race was made, a mile and an eighth. And on the Ragazin speed figure scale, he earned a 5.5 twice, the best Derby prep winner number leading in to the Run for the Roses in 2023. Two Fills has his first foals in 2025, and you get all that speed at Windstar for a fee of just $10,000. The fastest horse of the week ran on Thanksgiving Day at the fairgrounds in the Thanksgiving Classic. Back-to-back in that race for miles ahead, a 7-year-old gelding who won the 2023 Thanksgiving Classic by 4.5 lengths with the career-high buyer speed figure of 104. He was off the board in his next two starts, and he came back to defend that title Thursday at the lofty price of 15-1, and he ran down odds-on favorite Montalcino to win the Thanksgiving Classic by a head under C.J. Hernandez with the buyer figure of 101. Owned by Samantha Siegel's JMS Stable, trained by Paul McGee. Miles ahead, your fastest horse of this week. Our newest sponsor here on the TDN Riders Room happens to be Gainesway Farm, which is bringing you now the Gainesway Guest of the Week, which just happens to be Gainesway General Manager Brian Graves. Brian, thanks for taking the time. A lot of exciting things going on at Gainesway right now. Tell us about the stallion situation, including some of the new upcoming stallions you're looking forward to.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. You know, we're busy. We've got four new stallions this year, and we've got a young stallion at Gainesway making a lot of noise on the freshman sire list named McKenzie. So we're busy here. You know, that's the way you want to be if you're in the stallion business. So, you know, we're happy to have the action.
Well, Brian, you've got 12 stallions at Gainesway. You've got four new ones. Let's start off with the new ones. It seems like you guys have a fixation towards gray stallions. 12 stallions, 5 of them are gray. Let's talk about the first one, Sees the Gray, and what you're expecting and hoping from him. Was it not just announced that he's going to have a date with Goodnight Olive?
Yeah, I was going to save that little part, that little tidbit. But yeah, it was tweeted last night by John Stewart that he's going to send his, you know, his grade one mare Goodnight Olive to Sees the Gray in his first book. So, you know, obviously we couldn't be any more excited about that. Sees the Gray is a very, very good incoming stallion prospect. You know, we're really, really glad to have done the deal on him and really glad to have him here. Firstly, his name recognition has just been outstanding. As a dual grade one winner, son of Arrogate, he's, you know, just had a lot of shows at the farm and off to a really great start. Gotten a ton of mares right out of the bat. And so, you know, we're really excited about the potential. I think what he offers breeders just with his size and strength and good looks is just a throwback to Arrogate, who was cut out to be a good horse. And I think that blood doesn't want to die. And, you know, Sees the Gray is a really great opportunity.
So obviously the big gun in the stallion roster, Brian, has been and continues to be Tappet. I guess you could call him gray. He looks more white now in his old age. And he's done so much for the farm. I mean, you've got four sons of Tappet standing stud as well. Give us an update on what's going on with the old guy. How's he doing? And what has he meant to Gainesway over these last 10 or 15 years?
I mean, Tappet is just a dream horse. You know, he's a once in a lifetime horse. You know, the problem with Tappet is once your boss has had Tappet, he wants another Tappet. And, you know, the Tappets don't grow on trees. So, you know, he's carried Gainesway for the last 20 years, you know, really lifted the farm up and let the farm do more than the Gainesway did before we had Tappet. In terms of racing horses, you know, he's basically supplied the financial resources to do it. And I would say that it is because of Tappet and, you know, his current age as to why we have been aggressive in getting new horses, sons of Tappet, and really just more horses at Gainesway in general, so that we have a chance to get another horse, you know, remotely as good as Tappet has been for the farm.
I apologize for not looking this up in advance. How old is Tappet right now, and how's he doing?
Tappet is doing great. He is 24 this year.
Oh.
Last year, Tappet bred 80 mares. You know, this year we'll probably breed 60, 70 mares again. He's doing quite well. You know, he's active on the general sire list. He's still producing grade one winners. Arthur's Ride was a horse that won a grade one for Tappet this year. In addition to that, he had several graded stakes winners, grade two winners, grade three winners. You know, he's still a force. He can't breed quite the numbers to keep him, you know, as a number one stallion anymore on the general sire list, but he's very consistent and he can still get you a grade one winner. $2 million yearlings by him last year and three $900,000 yearlings right under that. I mean, people, they understand the power of Tappet. And, you know, he's an all-time leading grade one winning producing stallion. He's a champion stallion. And now, of course, he's one of the leading broodmare stallions in the world. So, you know, what is there to say about Tappet other than you just hope that you can fill his shoes one day with horses that are half that good?
We got plenty in the pipeline. What were the initial expectations? I know you weren't there to begin with when Tappet first arrived, because he wasn't an overnight success. He had to work at it and things had to go that way. So when you're looking at new stallions, are you trying to build them along the Tappet lines? How do you do that?
Man, I honestly think that, you know, for Gainesway, and the way Mr. Beck thinks about horses, you know, they just have to be qualified and they had to show a certain amount of brilliance, because, you know, if they have that, you know, I think that a really good stallion can come from anywhere. Tappet was probably not the most sought after stallion when he first came to stud. I believe his price was $3.6 million. And it was a partnership deal. And, you know, he had passed through the ranks of the largest, most competitive farms that, you know, that give the highest prices for stallion prospects. So, you know, but he had the magic gene, which produces runners and passes that gene along to his offspring. And then they in turn determine how good a stallion is going to be. So, you know, we think that stallions can come from anywhere. We like to see brilliance. You know, we love to see grade one wins, and we love to see some pedigree and you know, but we accept the fact that a good horse can come from anywhere, and the more chances you have, the better off you are.
So we know McKenzie was a good horse and he's off to a fast start at stud. Give us a little behind the scenes on McKenzie. What's he like around the farm, and what sort of character traits is he passing on to his offspring?
You know, he's all class. You know, he was on the racetrack. He was a four-time grade one winner. He won grade ones at 2, 3, and 4 years of age. You know, the first time I saw Mackenzie, I thought he was an absolutely beautiful headed horse with a lot of class. And he's got a very long kind of Bob Baffert neck and sloping shoulder. You know, he's passing those specific traits along to his offspring. You know, they have speed like him. Mackenzie was a horse who didn't actually make a start until October of his 2-year-old year. And so it's very encouraging to see how much success he's having as early as he is, because we feel and we hope that they will get even better with age. He's, you know, been a real breath of fresh air to Gainsway, and to be in a position now where he's the leading freshman sire today, you know, just makes everyone around here very proud. And it's nice to have the action at Gainsway and the hope that he can be a real significant stallion in the future, and one that can partially fill Tappet's shoes moving forward.
What has been the general thoughts about Muth? Because he's one of the ones I'm most excited to see, a $2 million 2-year-old coming in, you know, the usual Bob Baffert MO, but he's kind of a really cool looking horse who stands over a lot of ground. I'm not sure people realize quite how scopey he is.
Yeah, I was quite surprised to see, being a good son of good magic, how substantial he was in height and scope when I went to see him. And, you know, for me, he was a wow. He was an automatic yes when I laid eyes on him. Of course, I had seen him, as I know you had as well, at the Ocala 2-year-old sale where he topped the sale. He's just been a brilliant horse from the word go, really. And I saw him as a marquee kind of stallion acquisition opportunity for Gainsway. And, you know, really, Mackenzie was probably a big help in just our ability to secure a horse like Muth, because of a lot of the same people that were involved, like the qualifications of Muth as well. You know, he's a super looking horse. Son of good magic. He stands 16.5. Beautiful, long, sloping shoulder and neck, big hip, you know, really just a wow physical. You know, he was brilliant on the track from the word go. After he topped the sale in June, he wins his maiden race by 8 lengths, geared down, TDN Rising Star, you know, fractions of 21, 45 and change, geared down. You know, the horse wins the American Pharoah in the fastest time since American Pharoah himself won the race. He's second to Fierceness in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. He goes on and shows, which really very few horses can show, that they can stretch that speed and win at a mile and an eighth at 3. And Muth did that as well in the Arkansas Derby. And he did it against grade one winners. He did that against Timberlake, and he did it against the eventual Kentucky Derby winner, Mystic Dan. So, you know, he's just a marquee prospect. Very unlucky not to add a classic win to his resume when he was 2-5 in Preakness and got a fever. So, We're just really excited about the potential. He's been overwhelmingly popular here at the farm right off the first show. So we're really excited about him.
Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you an industry question, really, from 35,000 feet. I find the state of the thoroughbred industry right now to be very confusing. On one hand, the on-track product doing very well in some areas, but obviously, as we've talked about on this podcast often, in Southern California, it's really struggling. Then on the breeding side of it, the sales are going great guns, but yet the foal crop continues to decline. Can you make some sense out of all this?
I can't make a lot of sense. So, you know, I know that the foal crop has been shrinking, and that's an obvious concern. I think the sale question is probably just a matter of supply and demand. And, you know, with there not being as many on offer, I think that, you know, the ones that are there and the ones that are perceived as the better of the bunch, still bring a lot of money. You know, it's been my observation that it is a fair bit polarized as to what are perceived the best horses. And then when you get to the middle market and lower end, it's not quite so easy at all. So, you know, the market just remains very polarized, and, you know, but it is good to see, plenty of participation and plenty of demand for the horses that we are breeding.
When you say polarized, how do you define polarized?
Well, polarized is just when, you know, the market seems to all gravitate to the same horses, the same physical, the same horses that they think have a chance to become grade one winners and stars. And so you'll sell a horse for 1.2 million and then, you know, you'll sell a horse for 20,000. It's all the action seems to be in one spot. And then, you know, many horses that aren't perceived as that the best, you know, don't really get much action at all.
Gainsway sales are going great gangbusters. I mean, they seriously are going gangbusters the last few years, and you're basically at the head of all of it. And there's a lot of talk in the sales pitch, breed to sell, breed to race. Can you explain for somebody listening who doesn't know the difference, what is the main differences between those two theories, you're breeding to sell or breeding to race?
Well, the way I perceive it is that if you're breeding to sell, you're a commercial breeder and you raise your weanling or yearling with the idea that you're going to go to the sale and try to sell it, you know, and hopefully profitably. You know, if you breed to race, that horse will never see the auction place, and it's you know, bred to go immediately into training and to the track to race on your behalf.
You do a lot of penhooking. What do you look for? Because when I see Brian Graves purchased or bred as a weanling, usually there's a pretty hefty yearling sales price attached to it 6-9 months later. What do you look for? Can I pick your brains? Because you've done remarkably well pinhooking weanlings to yearlings, and even ones that would be from a no-name sire that I've never heard of. I'm like, oh, God, look, Brian's in control of this one. This one's going to look amazing. And it does. Like, what do you look for?
I mean, I think the market conditions someone, you know, to look for what, you know, most people want to buy, you know. So the market has conditioned me to like the looks of a certain type of horse. And, you know, over 20, 25, well, probably 30 years now of doing this, the market conditions you towards, you know, a certain type of horse that will run and perform as well. And so what I try to do is I find the perfect combination of the horse that I think will have a good chance to run, but also sell well. And so, you know, you just get conditioned to look for those kind of horses. Specifically, physically, you know, I like the type of horses that Wayne Lucas and Bob Baffert, you know, seemed to give more looks to when I was showing them when I was a kid. And then, you know, certain market conditions as you go into the market just teach you to be more refined and what to stay away from. I like horses that tend to be on the leg, with a certain amount of class and intelligence to their head. I like horses with sloping long necks and shoulders that have a really nice balanced top line into a nice strong hindquarter, into a nice hip. And, you know, that also will walk and show you a good deal of action at the walk. You know, and I think that that's not surprising. Everybody likes those type of horses. So you just have to kind of recognize what they look like when they're young and hairy and learn how that develops over time into something beautiful.
I've only got one more question, Brian, and it involves the breed to sell versus breed to race dichotomy. It may not even be fair to cite the old days, right? The 1940s and 50s and 60s, when you had the aristocratic families who were primarily breeding to race, whereas now the pendulum seems to have shifted to being primarily breed to sell. In your opinion, what are the differences in the types of horses that are being bred now in the breed to sell category as opposed to the old breed to race?
You know, I can only speak for the types of horses that we're breeding here and that our clients are breeding here. You know, I think it's what everybody does. They go for as much sire power as they can, that they can make a case of for their mare. And, you know, I think that they, in modern times, the difference would be that they look for a lot of speed, you know, and they look for it on both sides of the equation, I think. And so that's probably the main difference between years past, where there might have been more stamina and endurance. I think it's a natural reflex of current breeders and breeding to race or the commercial market to look for speed.
Brian, just one quick question. I can't look at you or think about Brian Graves without thinking about your great late father, Bill, and what a wonderful man he was. Is there a day that goes by that you don't think about Bill? And what would he think right now about the state of the industry if he's looking down from his golden cloud?
Bill was a horse enthusiast to the end. So as long as there were horses, he was going to be enthusiastic. There is not a day goes by that I don't think about my dad or think about the principles, you know, that he had, and, you know, try to improve something in our life, whether it be the stallions or the yearlings or the weanlings in any way, shape or form. That's just the way it was. When he'd come by, he'd find something wrong. He'd find it pretty quick and he'd tell you how to fix it. I've got Bill Graves. He's still right here and he's still whispering in my ear all the time. What I do wish is that he could see the success that we're having. I wish that he could see, you know, some of these stallions deals that we're doing. And I know he would have gotten a big kick out of that. And I know he would have liked to have taken his experience in sales and been a part of that moving forward. So, but we still, like I say, we still have him in spirit.
Well, you're carrying on those principles and his influence with you to Gainesway. Congratulations on the success of the farm, the new stallions, and thanks for taking the time. And thanks for being a supporter of the TD and Riders Room. We appreciate it.
We're happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
And the TD and Riders Room guest of the week, as we said, brought to you now by Gainesway Farm. You just heard Brian Graves talk about the four new stallions headed to Gainesway. And there was some news this morning about one of them. Resolute Racing's John Stewart, as we pointed out in the interview with Graves, announced Monday morning that he'd be sending two-time Breeders' Cup filly and mare sprint champion Goodnight Olive to Seize the Gray, the 2024 Preakness winner, who's standing his first year at stud at Gainesway in 2025. Stewart just purchased Goodnight Olive for $6 million last November. Stewart said, "We wanted to get this nailed down before Seize the Gray's book fills up."
PA Bred, I think we've built a brand at this point.
It's excitement at every step.
Roses for Deborah just set a new track record.
On average, for the past decade, Pennsylvania paid over $28 million a year in breeders' awards, restricted races, and owner bonuses. Plus, PA Bred shine on the world's biggest stage. Just three states have bred more Breeders' Cup winners. Learn more at PABred.com.
The TD and Riders Room, also brought to you by our friends at the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders Association. Save the date. The PHBA's annual Stallion Season Auction will be held January 13th through the 19th. You can bid online. Just go to thoroughlylybred.com. That's on the screen for you right there. There you see the website. You can keep checking back at pabred.com as well for an updated listing on available stallions. So you visit thoroughlybred.com in order to register and also to obtain more information about the Stallion Season Auction. And of course, to learn more about the PA Bred program in general, you can go to PABred.com or you can call the number we tell you about, 610-444-1050.
How do we segue that to the Kentucky Derby? Let me think. I'm not sure I'm that sharp, but we'll do that anyway. Guess who is the 13-1 individual favorite in pool two for the Kentucky Derby?
Really?
Can you guess? Yes.
Wow. Now, obviously, we're talking about the $3.2 million yearling named Barnes.
Correct.
Correct. Who broke his maiden last Wednesday, I believe it was, at Churchill Downs. Baffert ran that horse at Churchill Downs as his first starter at Churchill. And he was actually present for the race, which was a nice touch. His first starter at Churchill Downs since, of course, the infamous ban of Churchill Downs after the Medina Spirit controversy. So what was your opinion, Zoe, about Barnes?
Workmanlike. I think that's the only way I could put it, is workmanlike. A little bit green. He overcame it all. And it's almost like the Bob has his, quote, playbook in his back pocket. Because when they crossed the wire, he simply pulled out his playbook and said he had flashbacks of the 1996 Kentucky Derby with Cavanier and Grindstone coming flying down, because it was him stood next to Dwayne Lucas. You couldn't write a movie script any better than this. You've got Bill Castagnon there in the paddock with him. You've got Bill Mudd. You've got all the powers that be at Churchill Downs. And then you've got Bob Baffert and Dwayne Lucas standing together watching the race, and they run 1-2. I mean, this is a thing that movies are made of.
And furthermore, Barnes is owned by Amer Zidan, the owner of Medina Spirit. I don't know if Amer was actually there or not, but I mean, the horse, look, I mean, you know, career debut, buyer speed figure 87, which is very solid. It's, you don't want it to be necessarily too fast. Sometimes horses, you know, will go the wrong direction if they have to run an unbelievably fast race. But I thought he showed good determination. Innovator, the Lucas horse, ran a heck of a race. Yeah. Made a clear lead, going 5.5 furlongs. They separated 10.5 lengths away from the rest of the field. And Barnes was just a little bit more game than Innovator in the final 16th of a mile. Look, the time, let me spit that out, 5.5 and 102.97. You might think that would be even faster than an 87 buyer speed figure, but the racetrack surface at Churchill Downs was very fast on Wednesday. But 87 was good enough. It's good enough, obviously, to make Barnes one of the early favorites, according to the bookmakers, for the Kentucky Derby. I think that might be a little rich, but he's obviously bred to be a very good horse.
And the only person, ironically, who wasn't there was Jimmy Barnes, whom he's named after.
Really?
Yep. So Jimmy stayed home to take care of everything. And it was good. Bob should have been there. Like, Bob had to be at Churchill Downs. So we'll see moving forward. Bob back on. But yeah, Barnes taking the win there, maiden special weight, going 5.5 furlongs. The Clark. It just seems like Brian Hernandez and Kenny McPeak just continue winning races. They started off the year winning races, and then they carry on with rattle and roll. But that race was not run without some controversy.
Yes. First of all, Rattle and Roll. I mean, he's a horse that McPeak thought highly enough about that he wanted to run him in the Breeders' Cup Classic. I mean, he tried to get him into the Breeders' Cup Classic, and he just wasn't able to do it. He'd only had one start in 2024 prior to the Clark, and that was in the Lucas Classic, which he ran in for the second consecutive year. He wasn't the favorite. He was 9-5. Ran down a horse named Most Wanted, along with Hit Show, a couple of good horses from the Brad Cox barn, and he did it very gamely. I mean, it was an eventful kind of race behind him. There was a disqualification involved there, but I thought Rattle and Roll was a fairly deserving winner. And now they're talking about bringing him back maybe next time out in the Pegasus World Cup.
Hernandez becomes the second jockey in history to repeat the Derby Oaks Clark double since 1884, and that was Isaac Murphy. It does definitely puts an explanation mark onto the point you've been making about Kenny McPeak for Trainer of the Year.
Yeah, I think you can make a strong case for Kenny McPeak as Trainer of the Year. Like you said, we talked about that. It's not you know, it's not necessarily your prototype trainer of the year, which nowadays seems to be the trainer that's had the most purse money. That's either going to be in most years, Chad Brown or Bob Baffert or Todd Pletcher or Brad Cox. But McPeak won the Derby Oaks double. He had Torpedo Anna, of course, who dominated the three-year-old filly division and capped that season off with the win in the Breeders' Cup Distaff. And now he brings Rattle and Roll back on Thanksgiving weekend to win a grade one. McPeak has had a sensational year. I'm going to vote for him for Trainer of the Year. And it's not, you know, it's not in any way in my mind, to any kind of a black mark against the other guys. It's just that he's had a remarkable record-breaking type of campaign.
All right, we go east to west, and we talk about Formidable Man and Michael McCarthy. Formidable Man taking down the Grade One Hollywood Derby. He skipped the Twilight Derby, and it looks like everything's grand when a plan comes together, because he held off some good horses and was definitely much the best. And how about the connections, the City of Light connections here? Michael McCarthy campaigned for the Williams City of Light. He is the sire of Formidable Man. It all came full circle in the Grade One Hollywood Derby.
And Bill and Suzanne Warren, who, of course, also had St. Liam to win the Breeders' Cup Classic way back in the day. Look, Formidable Man showed a lot of gameness. It was a four-horse photo finish. He got a good trip. He was inside and tipped out when he needed to. But still, I mean, that's the third win in a row for Formidable Man, who is really, you know, putting his hat in the ring as a horse to be reckoned with. Now he's just a three-year-old, of course, Hollywood Derby. As you move forward to his four-year-old season. And McCarthy, I didn't read his post-race quotes, but, you know, he's certainly aggressive, sort of like Kenny McPeak, in that he'll have no hesitation if he thinks Formidable Man is good enough to ship him, let's say, to Gulfstream Park for the Pegasus World Cup turf. I mean, that I don't think would be out of the realm of possibility.
Not at all. And he was also very gracious in his post-race comments, which brings us in, and we're going to talk about Ben Cecil really quickly, who passed away just a few days ago. Ben Cecil was a stalwart here in Southern California, having been a young man coming over from England. He took over Rodney Rash's string when he was very young. And he's just a guy who epitomizes the true gentleman of the game that the sport is named after. Ben Cecil was a gentleman through and through, a guy who fought cancer for the last 10 years and always did it with a smile on his face. Ben never had a bad day. Just, you know, really, really sad.
We're lucky in this sport. And I've covered a lot of sports, right, from the NFL on down, to have a group of people as a whole who are very pleasant and easy to deal with. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that training racehorses in particular can be so challenging and so frustrating and so many lows. You can win 25% and, you know, be considered a Hall of Fame type trainer, losing 75% of the time. But Ben Cecil was one of those guys that you always, in my role in the media, going around and talking to trainers before any race, you always look forward to seeing. Look forward to visiting at the barn, you know, because he was such, like you said, a gentleman and such a nice guy. And then when you just run into him in the grandstand, you know, or on the barn area when he didn't have a horse that you needed to talk to him about, he would always, you know, shout you down, call you down and shake your hand. And it was just a fantastic guy and a sad day.
Thoughts out to Christy and the rest of his family as we celebrate Ben Cecil. Funeral arrangements are pending. Okay, Grade One Matriarch, not to Mr. Chad Brown, Sacred Wish. It was an East Coast shipper for George Weaver. What did you think of that race?
I thought it was an outstanding race, which the Matriarch typically would be. We talked last week about A.G. Bullitt.
Right.
And the fact that she would be a really tough filly to run down, mare to run down, if she was able to, she's a filly, she'll be a mare soon, if she was able to control the pace, which she did, and she controlled the pace in pretty reasonable fractions for a mile at Del Mar. And yet, Gina Romantica and Sacred Wish ran her down, and Sacred Wish ran her down at 12 to 1. Gina Romantica fired big, A.G. Bullitt fired big. But Sacred Wish, you know, bouncing back from, I'd say the last time she won a race was an allowance race at Aqueduct in May. She'd been close in grade three competition four times in a row. But at 12-1 with Johnny B, she gets the job done in a grade one. Good for George Weaver and the owners.
I didn't think there was any real excuse for Gina Romantica, did you?
No.
Johnny just got the jump.
And she ran a good race.
Yeah.
You know, she ran a really good race. You and I have talked about this. And Thoroughbred Racing, and this really hit home with me when every 4 years or 2 years when I cover the Winter Olympics and the Summer Olympics, right? Gold medal, silver medal, bronze medal. People are so excited when they win a silver or a bronze. A lot of times you can't tell the difference between someone who's finished second and third and someone who's won. And yet in horse racing, we're so fixated on the winner, on the winner's circle. And you get, you know, so many people are disappointed when they don't win. They run second, they run third. And this is one of those situations where, you know, they could be very proud of the way Gina Romantica won, very proud of the way AG Bullet ran. They both ran great races, but on this particular day, they just weren't quite good enough.
It's horse racing. If you ain't first, you're last.
That seems to be the, you know, sort of the overriding philosophy, which I find especially interesting during those times when I'm doing the Olympics. And I'm like, wait a second, these guys are celebrating finishing third, a bronze medal.
Maybe we should just give out medals instead of prizes. What do you think?
Or have horse racing in the Olympics.
Oh, God, that would be amazing. We should work on that. All right, do want to remind you that the TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by XBTV. And this week's XBTV Work of the Week is Phil Serrano. Phil Serrano was last seen winning the Big Ass, we can say that on this podcast, the Big Ass Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile. And this is his second work back since that win. He worked 5 furlongs in 101 and won, and you can see his rider is not asking him at all. In fact, you know what? I was out there on the apron and I watched him go by me and I didn't even realize it was him. I walked back with John's assistant, Alex Bisono, and I'm like, who's that? The guy in the orange. And he's like, that's the big horse, Phil Serrano. So he did look very good. He is now 2-for-3 since coming to the US from Argentina, finishing second in the Pacific Classic. His next start will be at Santa Anita, drumroll please, December 26th, opening day.
You know, Zoe, I heard all of this about how much Gary Young, the clocker, loved Phil Serrano, how much John Sadler loved Phil Serrano, how much all these people in California loved Phil Serrano in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile. Why didn't I hear any of this before the race?
Oh, I know.
They were saying it. I had my ears closed and I wasn't listening because you could have made a lot of money if you had some confidence in Phil Serrano.
Well, my good friend Michelle Yu loved Phil Serrano all week.
There's another one.
So she actually did make some money. And ironically, John Sadler was in Argentina this week looking for the next Phil Serrano. So we'll keep you posted on that.
Be a smarter better with XBTV, the best horses. With thousands of exclusive morning workouts. All at your fingertips and delivered right into your inbox. Everything you need to be informed. Be smart. Bet smart with XBTV.
With some of the fullest fields in the country and quality racing year-round, there's never been a better time to reap the rewards of breeding and racing in Kentucky. Purse money in Kentucky is at an all-time high, as is average purse per race, outpacing California, Florida, and New York. Kentucky breds. Breed them. Raise them. Race them. We all win.
The TDN Writers' Room also brought to you by the KTOB, the Kentucky Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association. Since we started this podcast 15, 20 minutes ago, here are the horses that we've talked about already. We talked about Patch Adams and how impressive he was breaking his maiden on Saturday at Churchill Downs. We talked about Chasen, the half-sister to Idiomatic. We talked about Rattle and Roll, who won the Clark. We talked about Formidable Man in the Hollywood Derby. We talked about Sacred Wish, running down Gina Romantica to win the Matriarch. All five of those horses, in addition to the horses we're getting ready to talk about, have one thing in common. More than one, probably. They're all fast. But they all happen to be bred in Kentucky. And that is no accident. Kentucky breds breed them, raise them, race them. We all win.
Bravo. That segment brought to you by Randy Moss. Fresh off the cuff as we move on and talk about perhaps some more Kentucky breds. Golden Rod winner, Jockey Club winner. How good is Good Cheer?
Very good.
Yeah.
She arguably may be better than Immersive, who, of course, won the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies. Both happen to be trained by Brad Cox, owned and bred by Godolphin. They both happen to be now 4-for-4 lifetime. No, Good Cheer maybe hasn't faced quite the level of competition as Immersive did, but close, because the filly that Good Cheer beat in the Golden Rod was Quiet Side, the short-leaf stable filly, who also ran against Immersive and ran pretty well in the Breeders' Cup. Quiet Side had 6 lengths on the rest of the field, so it was a very strongly run race. Good Cheer's 4 races now. Let me do the math. 13, 30, 32 and a half lengths of total winning margins. Back-to-back wins now on the Rags to Riches and the Golden Rod, and it's an embarrassment of riches right now, especially in the 2-year-old filly division for Godolphin and Brad Cox.
I mean, she'll be one of the finalists, right, for 2-year-old champ? Obviously, Immersive will get it.
She should be.
Yeah.
Immersive will get it just because she won the Breeders' Cup and Good Cheer didn't compete. But, hey, you know, numbers-wise, Good Cheer has run 3 races now of her 4 with a faster buyer speed figure than Immersive has ever run. So, and it's going to be interesting to see how Brad keeps these separated, because he'll have a full string at the fairgrounds. He'll have a full string at Oaklawn Park. He tends to keep most of his better 3-year-olds, colts and fillies, stabled at the fairgrounds because the weather is a little more predictable and a little more stable at the fairgrounds. You don't have the freeze thaw and mistraining that you have sometimes at Oaklawn. But he ships horses freely, his top 3-year-olds, which we saw last year, back and forth between the two. So, you know, he's going to try to keep Immersive and Good Cheer separated. One will be focused primarily on the Oaklawn 3-year-old filly races leading up to the Kentucky Oaks, and the other one in New Orleans.
You know, somewhere that has good weather all winter long, just, you know, throwing it out there. Southern California, Brad Cox, if you're listening, we've got room out here for you. Just throwing that out there. Okay. Who won the Jockey Club? I can't even remember.
Godolphin, of course.
Again.
Not trained by Brad Cox. This one trained by Owen Hardy, who's worked for Godolphin for a long time. Nice to see Owen in the winner's circle with a Godolphin 2-year-old named First Resort, the son of Uncle Mo, who was 6-1. He wasn't one of the favorites. He got the jump on Jonathan's Way, headed to the stretch. He had a nice stalking trip, sitting second, just about a length or so off the pace. Luis Saez, who also rode the Godolphin filly Good Cheer in the Golden Rod, was on First Resort. Quickly, nice turn of foot to open up 3 lengths on Jonathan's Way. Jonathan's Way couldn't really cut into that margin too much. I mean, he was the logical favorite in the race, and he ran well. Tistastic was 3rd, but First Resort on this particular day was best. And look, we probably undersell what Godolphin has done in the United States with their transition, in this country at least, from grass to dirt over the last 20, 25 years or so. It's been remarkable how Godolphin, when they decided to focus on breeding dirt horses for American racing, how dominant they have become. When you look at the Eclipse Awards for Champion Breeder, the Eclipse Awards for Champion Owner, they've recently been dominated by Godolphin, and Godolphin is ending 2024 as fast as they started it.
Well, let's give a shout out as well to trainer Owen Harty, who has trained for Godolphin longer than probably Brad Cox has been training. He trained the Dam. In fact, his last graded stakes winner, now you've reminded me who the winner was Fair Maiden, who won the Grade 1 La Brea at 20-1 with Ricky Gonzalez. That was the last time Owen won a graded stake. He's got more air miles than you can swing a cat at. He goes backwards and forwards from Kentucky to Florida to California every single week, keeps 2 strings going, and manages to do it with a smile on his face and some very good humor indeed. So props to a trainer who perhaps doesn't give the credit that he is deserved in Owen Hartey, one of the good guys of the game. All right, let's look forward and see what's happening this weekend. We've got a lot going on at Aqueduct. And I know that Bill wanted to talk about Aqueduct, and we'll start with perhaps the one that Bill wanted to talk about. And Bookham Dano has won on Saturday in the Grade 2 Cigar Mile. Is this a slam dunk with the rad riding?
This is a good race. I wouldn't call it a slam dunk, but I definitely think that he's the horse to beat. I think probably the horse Mulliken would be the one, and Senor Buscador. Those two, I think, would be the ones that would be the biggest threats. Post Time also. So let's add Post Time in there, coming off the second to Full Serrano in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile, and a horse who just seems to run his race every time. So you see, it's a loaded field. But Bookham Dano is just such a sharp horse around one turn. I think a one-turn mile might be his best distance. He is a come-from-behinder. He's not a sheer speed type horse. When he gets beat, it's usually because someone gets the jump on him. But remember, the last time Bookham Dano ran a one-turn mile was in Saudi Arabia when he separated with Forever Young. And Forever Young was life and death, as they like to say, to run him down, and just got there to beat him by a head, leaving Ben Tornado six lengths in their wake. And we know how good Ben Tornado has turned out to be after that. That was a one-turn mile. This is his first one-turn mile since then. I don't like the post, number one post necessarily, but he's not really a close-up stalker, so he'll be in the back half of the field probably. And since he's Irad, probably will find a way to work himself out. I think he deserves to be the favorite, but as a three-year-old running against some of these horses like Mulliken and Post Time, I wouldn't call it a slam dunk.
Can we do a head-to-head between you and Bill? His favorite horse, Bookham Dano, your favorite horse, Senor Buscador. I will actually donate the mythical bottle of wine you owe me to the winner of this head-to-head battle.
It's mythical at this point, isn't it? It's been, I even forgot what we were betting about. I think you were third and I was fourth or something like that, but you won. Yeah, that's fine with me. But although I don't think Senor Buscador is quite as sharp as Bookham Dano is. Senor Buscador, by the way, was second in the Cigar Mile last year. He was beaten a long way by a horse named Hoist the Gold, who was Dallas Stewart, really red hot at that time, drew off and won that race by 4.5 lengths. It was a fast rail that day on a muddy track at Aqueduct, which didn't play into Senor Buscador's strengths. But wouldn't it be cool to see Senor Buscador, if indeed he's going to stud, which they say he probably will, to go out with a win in the Cigar Mile. That would be cool. And maybe even, you know, some of those other races to come overseas.
It would. I'll give you the winner right now. It's going to be locked. All right, let's move on. The race before, the Grade 2 Demoiselle Stakes, going a mile and an eighth. Do you have any real opinion in here?
No, you know, it's before we did this podcast, and I was looking at Good Cheer, Brad Cox, Immersive, Brad Cox. So I went on my database and I decided, you know, what other good, I know he's got a lot. What are the good two-year-olds does Brad Cox have? And lo and behold, this filly pops up. I didn't even know anything about her. Muhima, who is the Shadwell filly who gets the rail in the Demoiselle, stretching out from one turn to a mile and an eighth, like most of these horses are. But Muhima, it's by Munnings, out of a Tappet mare. She's 2-for-2 lifetime by a combined 13-length margin. She's low 80s buyer speed figures, which tops the list of all the horses that are running here. So it looks like Brad Cox is going to be in a pretty good spot to get another graded stakes win with yet another two-year-old filly, in my opinion.
One race before, as we're going backwards here, race number 7, the Grade 2 Remsen Stakes. We already talked about the Kentucky Derby. Does this still have points? I can't remember. Are there points in the Remsen?
I don't know for sure.
Yeah, there may be. Who do you like in here? You've got Tux draws the rail for Billy Mott, who seems to be winning everything inside. Owen's got one in there. Poster, he's 2-for-2, another progeny of Munnings.
Numbers-wise, Keywaydin is a very, very interesting horse. He's a Chad Brown horse owned by OXO Equine of Larry Best. And Keywaydin ran down a Mark Cassie horse, a very good Mark Cassie horse by the name of Volt. I say ran him down. He actually made the lead on Volt in a very fast maiden race at Aqueduct back in the second week in October. Now, Keywaydin already was touting himself at that point. He had lost in a very good maiden race to a horse named Tip Top Thomas, who came back and ran well in Stakes Company with an 85 buyer speed figure. So he was 1-5 when he ran against Bolt in that maiden race at Aqueduct, and he won it. Bolt was 10 lengths ahead of the third place finisher with a 91 buyer speed figure, among the fastest buyers that we've seen, you know, on the list of top 10 or so fastest buyers that we've seen from two-year-olds this year. So I think Keywaydin is going to be a pretty solid favorite in here. Owned by Larry Best. He's obviously a son of Instagrand.
Yeah.
One of Best's, probably the best horse Best has ever had. Studley Do Right, who was the Nashua winner, is probably going to be the second choice in here. But yeah, on paper, it's probably not the best Nashua, but or Remsen rather. But, you know, you don't really know. These are improving two-year-olds. Until you see a horse like Keywaydin and see how he looks. He may come out of this race being one of the Kentucky Derby favorites. You don't know.
He might. Race number four is the Gopher Wand. I'm going to skip over that one and bring it back to Southern California, as we do have the Grade Two Starlet on Saturday as well. Looks like it's Bob's got quite a few in there. Tanma. Vodka with a Twist will be interesting going forward for Phil D'Amato. Should she run? Obviously, entries are not out yet. We're recording this on Monday. Nooney's in there, maybe. Practical Dream, a nice filly of Bob's called Cipriani. She's 2-2. So we'll see who goes forward in the Starlet, one of the last graded stakes of the year.
Yeah, this is my favorite time of the year, Zoe, when it comes to, you know, October, November, December. Not just the Breeders' Cup either, because you see so many nowadays, especially of these quality two-year-olds that are just now getting into gear and they're being unveiled. Like, you can look at the Saturday card at Churchill Downs on the undercard of the Goldenrod and the Kentucky Jockey Club. And the entire day was nothing but two-year-old races. And there were all sorts of well-bred horses that ran fast that looked really, really good. You combine that with what you see with Baffert's horses on the West Coast, with Barnes, who we saw on Wednesday. You get some horses in New York like Keywaydin. You can make a list of about 25 or 30 two-year-olds that have looked really good in maiden or allowance company that, if they continue to develop, you know, could be legitimate Kentucky Derby type horses. And it just becomes fun to follow this time of year. And these races on the West Coast that you're talking about this next weekend are just part of the mix.
Isn't it funny how times have changed? Because I can remember 10, 15 years ago salivating over the DRF in April at Keeneland. Yeah. Looking forward to the two-year-old races in April, because that's where we were going to find our Derby horse. You can't find one now in April. There's no shot. They're not running.
And a lot of times they don't run at Saratoga either. A lot of times they're not ready to run even in August at the Saratoga meet. It seems like just more and more lately, trainer, because the horses are more lightly raced than ever before. They go into the Kentucky Derby with four lifetime starts, sometimes three lifetime starts. Used to be that would be a black mark against horses. Trainers would try to avoid that at all cost. In the old days, if you saw a horse with only four lifetime starts going into the Derby, something bad happened, right? I mean, the horse either got really sick or was injured. There was some negative explanation as to why the horse was that inexperienced. Now it's almost like trainers prefer that as opposed to having more and more races in a more robust campaign. So they don't get started sometimes until September, October, November.
It's a good job Bill's not here. He'd be having a heart attack right now.
Yes, he would. The TD and Riders Room brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds, which got a big win on that Saturday card at Churchill Downs in the Ed Brown Stakes with her three-year-old hard-spun colt named Keep It Easy. Keep It Easy won the Ed Brown by 5 lengths over the 4-5 favorite Tough Catch, despite breaking a little slowly from the starting gate. Nice turn of foot at the top of the stretch. Keep It Easy now joins Bullard and Sandman on the early radar for the Kentucky Derby for West Point, which owns the colt along with Vinnie Viola, St. Elias Stable, and CJ Thoroughbreds. To learn more about West Point, you can
can visit them online at westpointtb.com.
All the thrills, fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
I think we're done. That is it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers' Room. For myself, Zoe Cadman, for Randy Moss, for our Gaines Way guests of the week, Mr. Brian Graves, Katie Petruniak, Sue Finley, Anthony LaRocca, and Aaliyah LaRocca. I think I've got everybody in there. For Lucy the dog, for Doodle over there sleeping, and everybody else. We'll see you next time. Cheers, Randy.
Cheers.